You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Around the Block, presented by Federal Prison Authority. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings. We'll have an action-packed show for you today. Real quick, I faltered last week, but today's show is sponsored by, in part, FCI Texarkana, established 1940. It's a low-security institution with a camp. Texarkana has just been a homesteader, a long-time institution, and services a lot of inmates in the Arkla, Tex region, or Texas, Oklahoma, and everybody else. So, have these folks with us in spirit today with their coffee cup.
I've been putting my FPC Seymour Johnson coffee mug.
I'm going to dig it out. If you don't dig this out, I'm going to dig mine.
I know I have it, and I literally carried it with me for 30 years location to location.
And then when you need it, on your podcast, you don't have it.
I still have boxes I haven't unpacked yet. So,
well, Susan, I know that we had a question or a concept that got brought up. We got to address that first.
Sure. So, I noticed this week we had a question posed about in transit time, holdover time, and there were a lot of comments, and the comments were kind of all over the place. So, I thought that might be something good just to start the show off with to explain. Yes. Why holdover time, in transit time, on programming days? So when someone is convicted, whether they're sitting in a Bureau detention center or they're sitting in a county jail or a marshal contract facility waiting for designation and transfer to their designated facility, even though they've been sentenced, they're not getting programming days. And a lot of folks will be like, but the law says, and actually, if you look at the law, what it says is that you can't earn federal time credits prior to your sentence, the commencement of your sentence. And the commencement of your sentence and your commitment date, the date you show up at your designated facility, is two different things. And, as we've talked about, kind of in previous shows, with like risk and need assessments and how we do all of that, the Bureau incorporated that into their initial classification intake and initial classification process. And that doesn't happen in holdover. Even if you're sitting in a detention center, you're in Los Angeles or Chicago or San Diego, any of those Bureau detention centers, holdover time, you're actually still in marshal's custody. And even though you're physically sitting in a bureau facility, you could just as easily be sitting in a marshal contract facility or in a jail or at home waiting voluntary surrender status. So everybody starts at the same point. They start when they reach their institution and they go through that initial classification process. They complete their assessments. Everything is done. Everything is loaded, and that's when they start earning programming days. And while the section of the law doesn't say, you start earning days here, it tells us when you can't earn days or earn time credits. But programming days are tied into that section of the statute that tells the Bureau everything that they have to do in order to implement this program. That's where we get the risk and need assessment, the team meetings where we're identifying needs they're identifying needs and assigning programs. It's not just about being in a Bureau facility. It's not just about serving time. It's really that structured assessment and linkage to programming, and then the agreement to participate, because obviously you can still choose not to program. You just don't get the benefits of time credits. But again, you're not earning time credits directly, like good conduct time. You accumulate programming days that are cashed in for time credits. And you can't accumulate programming days until you've started the process.
But so, you do accumulate GCT days or, you know, regular days off the
right. Of the good conduct time is just a function of the sentence. So when they calculate your sentence in Grand Prairie, you know, they do the math. It's 54 days times, you know, the number of years, and it's prorated. It's actually 4.5. It's 4.5 days per month for those wanting to know. So, but that's just a function of your sentence. Time credits aren't a function of your sentence or just a function of your sentence. It has all of these other check the box things you got to do before you start accumulating those days. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
Let me open up a can of worms, and we could do a whole show on the can of worms. So I'm going to preface it by saying, you know, this detention time, whether it's an FDC, MDC, and you're going into your designated joint, or let's say you're a U.S. Marshal prisoner also in a county jail somewhere, right? And you get jail time credit for that. And just remember, it's got to be purely federal, right? No state, you know what I mean? You're not finishing one thing from a state and then the feds pick this up and all this other stuff. So we get a lot of those calls too. I don't want to burn up a lot of time on that, but it's got to be pure federal, pure that case time.
Right. There are some asterisks, you know, if your federal judge ordered your federal sentence concurrent to your state time, but those are few and far between. Those are not the norm. So yeah, it really all comes down to jurisdiction, and we could spend a whole day talking about jurisdiction, and it gets kind of confusing at times when who arrested you, who filed a writ,
first.
What, yeah.
So yeah. We won't do that, but I did want to throw that in there because I got two calls on that this week. I know I didn't involve you in those, but I had to explain that. And basically, I'll just tell everybody other. So he's been in and out of these pretrial statuses. He finished up a state commitment. Okay, that's great. But and I think there may have been a period where he might have been fed only. I'm not sure. And I just told the woman that when he gets to his designated institution to call us, and then we'll be able to take a look and see if there's anything that we can capture with jail time credit. I don't think so. From what I heard, but yeah. I just said, look, and the guy's got 72 months, so we got plenty of time to figure that out. It's not like right. He's an immediate release by any stretch of the imagination. Right. But that's just kind of cluing in onto some of the calls we get. So today's topic is the sheet.
The infamous federal time credit worksheet.
The worksheet.
And really everything a person needs to know about time credits is on the worksheet. excuse me. It covers if you're not eligible, why are you not eligible? If you're not accumulating programming days, why not? What's going on? You know, did you get in trouble and get some disciplinary segregation? Disciplinary segregation, by definition, is considered non-programming days. Were you in transit? Did you get on the wait list for something and then decline it? And then 2 weeks later, realize the error of your way and go back and enroll. But now you've squandered all that wait list time because, of course, individuals are accumulating programming days on that kind of good faith that they're going to take the class. And when the time comes to take the class and they go, yeah, I've changed my mind, or I don't want to do that right now, and they're put in decline status, mm-hmm. all those good faith programming days just evaporate. But everything you need to know is on there. And that's why, you know, when we're talking to people, that's kind of our first question. Do you have a current worksheet? Because we can tell a lot looking at that worksheet. And that's not to say there's never errors on the worksheet. We were looking at a case today where worksheet looked one way And it looked like there was some credit owed. And in fact, the worksheet, when it was calculated, there was something happened. It didn't calculate correctly. And we reached out to kind of find
it. And there were no days credited for a particular
month. There were no disallowances. Right.
And so then without, there's no evidence. No, this is great because this is what we do. And y'all need to listen, man. I mean, this is going to apply to somebody, probably applies to probably 200 of our 11,000 members. Okay. So for whatever reason, right, you hadn't opted out everything. Everything's okay. But for whatever reason, you just didn't get the credits for a particular month. And now he's...
Well, and it looked like what it did was it calculated, it didn't capture some in-transit days for whatever reason.
Oh, yeah.
Don't have an answer, you know.
In transit off of his regular sentence date, huh?
Right. He was just transferring from one institution to another, so he had in transit days. But those in transit days were not on the worksheet for whatever reason. It could have been.
Is he a Marshall's prisoner on in transit day?
No, he was transferring from one institution to another.
So he's still a card carrying person. Okay.
Still, yeah. And it could have been the institution may have keyed an incorrect assignment that on the day it ran, it wasn't keyed correctly. I mean, that's, you know, we talk about that in the book about, you know, errors happen for different reasons.
You think he could have been left on the parent institution's count?
No, it could have been that the because he was in transit at a bureau facility as well. So it could have been the in-transit facility, instead of keying him as a holdover, keyed him as designated. Not sure what happened. Like I said, when in the book, we talk about the different types of errors. And sometimes it's a simple keying error, you know, transposing two numbers, entering the wrong assignment. And then once it's caught, it's fixed. And then when the calculator reruns, it catches that the bad code has been caught, and it fixes it. You can't. You're always going to deal with an element of human error. That's just
for sure.
The reality is of working with human beings.
Will we ever get to the bottom of this particular mystery, or just like, oh well, something happened, but they're going to fix it anyway, and they know to fix it. And it's going to be fixed, and the guy lives happily ever after.
Yeah, it's going to be fixed. A lot of times it's identifying what the problem is. So in addition to I'm not earning, why? Well, it's going to tell you why. I'm not eligible, why? It's going to tell you why. They're going to put that information on the worksheet. You also have, and of course, we've spent a lot of time talking about conditional release days and conditional placement dates. That information is always a snapshot, but again, it gives the information on the day it was run, and understanding that what those definitions are, understanding that a FSA conditional release date is talking about that first 365 days. Now, we had another case, individual has no supervision to follow. So we look at the top of his worksheet, right? And it says, eligible to apply toward release, no. And it says, no supervised release. Now go to the bottom of the worksheet, right? And it has his good conduct time release date as his projected release date. And his FSA release date is NA, right? Because he can't earn time credits toward early release. No supervision. But then you go to the FSA conditional placement date, and there are days there. For whatever reason, the unit team missed that, didn't understand that. Those folks with no supervised release are really, really a fractional minority of folks. Most folks have supervised release anywhere from 1 to 5 years, depending on their circumstances. And so it was one of those things where they were looking at it and they saw the no, and no supervised release and forgot about, and it happens again, those condition, that conditional release information didn't come out until October.
Right.
And of course they were already, in this particular case, they were already looking at a referral date at that point in time. And so it just, it wasn't, I think today it's in everybody's kind of vernacular that, oh, we've got place conditional placement dates and we got conditional release dates. Last fall, that wasn't the case. So again, now we're trying to help him and get that fixed. And hopefully we'll see that fixed.
It is interesting to see with these new policies and the First Step Act and the application of credits and understanding that with it, the evolution of case management, you know what I mean? How this has really evolved. And I'm going to tell you, both of us are graduate trained, doctoral level trained folks. And I mean to tell you, man, this is stuff can be a little bit of rocket science-y now, you know, if you were just kind of coming up and, you know, you're a good officer and you get that 7-9-11 case management spot, you're like, man, you got to be ready cognitively to this is a kind of a learning curve here.
Absolutely. Know? And it doesn't help that, just kind of even explaining how the conditional release date is calculated, how the conditional placement date is calculated. And it's this kind of, and we talked about it at the last show, you've got your time served moving in and that's kind of accumulating and then days are coming and you get to this point in the middle, right? Where right. The amount of credit you've earned is equal to the remaining time to serve, kind of in equilibrium. If you think about the scales, right? The old fashioned scale with the two tins, right? They're even at that point. That's that maximum benefit date.
Right.
Yet people continue to go, but am I earning credit in halfway house? How many times have we seen that question on the Facebook page? I don't understand. Am I still earning time credits in halfway house? Well, the answer is yes. Ish, because you can't do anything with them. You're already, if your maximum benefit date is that conditional placement date,
right?
You have now accumulated the most number of days that you can use.
Right.
Because you still have to have those days left in order to use them.
Well, I mean, just like this guy who's going to be an immediate release, hopefully this week or tomorrow, he was still earning in the halfway house, I mean, toward his date, toward his conditional FSA release date. So you're still earning towards that. But yeah, if you're, people that were out on CARES Act, on home confinement for years, like, man, what else can I get? I'm like, you're already in the community.
Yeah, there's nothing else.
I get this. Right. I'm like, you're already on home confinement.
There's nothing else. And they're like, but I'm still earning days. And they're like, okay, but there's nothing to do. There's no third door. And we've talked about that. And it's a flaw in the law. And because the way, the Bureau initially wasn't going to do it this way, right? The law is written that says, Bureau, you have the discretion to either award halfway house or home early release, time toward transfer supervised release, or time toward pre-release placement. And the initial model was we were only going to apply time credits toward advancing your release date until you hit 365 days or 18 months from release. And then everything after that would have been toward home confinement. It was to avoid this very situation that we're in. Elections have consequences. The new now previous administration didn't want to do that. And so that's what we're doing now is this applying credits right up to the release. It's created other problems. Obviously, until the conditional release date calculator was generated, let's see, where are we? That was October of 23, so about a year and a half ago. Case managers were referring folks based on their earned credit to the halfway house. And then by the time the halfway house, and they were just kind of adding in extra SCA days on the hope that by the time they transferred, you know, and more dates were accumulated, it would kind of all balance out. And the same thing with the conditional release date calculator. Until that rolled out and that information was available, there was just, all they could do was kind of recommend extra SCA days and hope that by the time the transfer actually happened, you know, they weren't underwater at that point with their time credits. So, like I said, case managers have gotten tons of data that's now coming at them. We're starting to see things level out a little bit, at least on the case management side. We're seeing more and more folks correctly referred based on their conditional release date for the shorter sentences. But, and I realize those with shorter sentences, had the Bureau kept with that original model, they wouldn't get to be done with their prison time as soon, but they would have been guaranteed halfway house home confinement placement. Most of those folks with shorter sentences have the verified home plan, can go right to home confinement, but because they're now going to home confinement, as we've talked about under the Second Chance Act, they're not maximizing that time.
Well, they're not getting, they're not getting a lot, if anything.
Right. And I foresee it getting worse as we get through the fiscal year.
Right. And again, where are we at? Tomorrow is April 1st, 2025. So, you know, here we are at this moment in time. The climate of halfway house home confinement is even way different than it was a year ago. Remember, we've been on the show when the film first started saying, yeah, man, we had these two guys and they got a year at the halfway house. And we're like, yay, high five, gone. I mean, unless that's on the Mexican border or something, there's a lot of space and there's just tumbleweeds rolling in the halfway house. I mean, there's just, you're just not going to get that. I mean, that thing's just tightened up. And so, you know, that's what we want y'all to realize, man. And, you know, don't kill the messenger. You know, I mean, people call us and we say, look, man, you know, now you're lucky to get this, maybe that, or get the other thing. Or they'll say, somebody says, they look at the recommendation from the halfway house, from the case manager is like 150 to 180 days. We knew that was going to happen. Like, no, you didn't know that was going to happen because the RRM has the say on how much.
And most of this folks today are getting reduced placements. We are pleasantly surprised. Yes. When we see somebody who gets
5 months, 6 months,
5 months, 5.5 months.
And they're not an RDAP case.
Right. And then the other problem, you know, the thing we do a lot of is that calculating the earliest home confinement eligibility. Another thing that they're not looking at in the Bureau because they're prioritizing that release and getting those folks the credit to get them released. But that by us calculating that, again, because the home confinement time is attached to the actual release date, which for our folks who have shorter sentences, they just keeps moving every month.
So Elon,
trying to catch it is a challenge.
Right. So Elon Musk, if you're listening, here's a way to save money. Attach the home confinement date to the other projected dates so that we can get these folks in home confinement sooner, and that saves the government and the taxpayer money, and the mandate rate is cheaper on home confinement than it would be.
I will go one step further, eliminating the 10% restriction. It just doesn't make sense.
After
the CARES Act and seeing folks in home confinement for 2-3 years, we had a client he had over 3 years in, and he was trying to get a relocation, remember? And then he got clemency. And it made sense. Those folks that at the time that President Biden issued that batch of 1,200 clemencies, the first one, There were folks in halfway house that had been, or home confinement, had been in home confinement anywhere from at that point about 14, 15 months up to more than 3 years. And that is a very, very long time to be in home confinement. I realize it might be better than being in prison, but that is a very long time to have an ankle monitor and a perimeter.
That we have clients that call us that have been on home confinement. Man, I got, can I just cut this thing off my ankle or whatever?
Don't do that.
Don't do it.
Don't do that. But like, so talking about the worksheet, I kind of got sidetracked a little bit in my brain. You know, if you think about when we talk about the worksheet, we talk about the different bands, and that's just kind of referring to the different sections because it goes through different sections horizontally. As you go down the page, right, they kind of partition off. And every single time an individual goes in or out of earning status, whether it's because they were at an outside hospital, they got DS, they went out on writ, whatever the reason is, every single time it changes, it will create a new band. And it is cumulative. So it's going through each month. It is looking at an in-person's entire record, the application is, and generating that worksheet that's covering each section. So if there is an error, even if nobody noticed it and you weren't paying attention, and you're looking at it and you're going, wait a minute, and it was 2 years ago, it can be fixed. It's really challenging. It can be fixed. But we see again, and then the next time it posts, that old bad data is gone. So when you're looking at it, it is cumulative. It does have everything. So, which is a good thing. And paying attention to worksheets, you know, one of the things we talked about, how do I as an individual going through federal prison, getting my time credits, reduce the likelihood that there's going to be an error? Review your timesheet. Every time you come to team, if the case manager doesn't have it ready, ask for it. By policy, every individual is entitled to that copy of that worksheet and their pattern and their needs assessment. And ask for it and look at it. Save your last one and compare it. Those are some of the things that we talk about is, you know, look for the differences. Do you know if you had DS time, right? You know what should be there and what shouldn't be there. And comparing your last worksheet to the current worksheet, save them. Then send them home to your family so that they have them. A lot of times we'll get calls about my time credits are wrong. And the first thing we ask for is a worksheet. And the second thing is, what do you think is wrong? Like, what are you looking at that you're saying this one point here isn't correct? Last week we looked at one and I went through the whole thing and I was like, I'm not seeing anything. Like, everything looks right. And going back to the family, have him tell us what he thinks is wrong. He could be mistaken, right? His time credits could be right. But one of the things we also do, because you and I are big advocates of education, right, is we will explain to our families so they can explain to their loved ones why it's correct. They're not, you know, their loved one isn't getting gypped out of time. He's not eligible or she's not eligible, or they're not eligible for this section of time for this reason. And because if it's not an error, if it is right, we want everybody to know why what you're seeing is right. Even if you don't like it, you need to know you're not being gypped out of time. And that's really important too.
And I know that you spend a lot of time delving into those, each and every entry and whatever else, to see why it's right. And so, you know, if you've retained us, right, and they say, okay, we're going to do this exhaustive check to see what's going on and find out, well, it's correct and here's why. Well, that's as much effort, if not more effort, than if something was wrong and then we're going to fix it and get you the credit. Does that make sense? It's still the work. You're still working. You know, right. We're still working. We're still emitting effort. And so, you know, a lot of times you can't, the work's the work. Sometimes the outcome is either positive.
Sometimes the outcome isn't necessarily what's desired. But remembering that there might not be an error, the misunderstanding may be on the individual. Not as we talked about, this is complex. So not, thinking you're getting a certain credit and you don't might not be a function of that it's wrong. It just might be a function of we need to do some more education.
Right.
And we do a lot of that. But, talking about documents and when something is right or wrong, when someone contacts about us about custody classification or pattern, right, the first thing we're asking for is the pre-sentence investigation report. I mean, we're going to ask, have you had any incident reports and some other programming stuff? But our first question is, we need to review your PSR. Because the pattern worksheet, which is important for time credits, again, someone who's not getting time credits, first thing we ask is, are you lower minimum risk? And again, if you're medium risk, that's going to be on that worksheet. But then we go through and we look at the pattern worksheet. And the only way to correctly assess the pattern worksheet is to be looking at the PSR. Because the pattern worksheet, the case managers don't enter data directly into the pattern worksheet. They push a button and then the system pulls data from different things. They're pulling it from the education record. They're pulling it from the drug treatment programming. They're pulling it from the disciplinary record. And they're pulling it from the custody classification. So if there's an error in pattern, it's because there's an error in one of those source documents. And we need to look at that. And much of those source documents, the big chunk, that custody classification, comes from the PSR. Yes, changes happen as a function of completing a program or getting an incident report or not getting an incident report. But the bulk of that is right out of the PSR. And that's why that document is so critical.
It is critical. And folks, we know that the PSR is a document that's, a court document. Some families are able to get it. Some, aren't. Some attorneys will share it with a family member or power of attorney. Some attorneys won't. So we understand that can be an issue. But if we do have access to that document, we can really go through it and score it out, if you will, right? And see if there's a discrepancy. So
we just did that with a client this last week, being scored out with some things that was elevating his security level, but was also impacting other stuff. And the family was able to get us the PSR, and he has started the informal process, and we're waiting to see how that goes. Again, getting something fixed isn't always as easy as, hey, this is wrong, fix it here. See, sometimes the best process is that sending that request to the warden is getting a response in writing, because if the institution is looking at something differently than when we look at it, if we have that information, then we go, oh, wait, see, this is where they're wrong.
And even if the administrative remedy goes up to the regional level, there'll be some lawyers or legal folks looking at it.
Absolutely. Right? The administrative, it's funny, with all that's going on, sometimes we see chatter about, oh, a way to save money is eliminate the regional offices. I think people don't necessarily understand the role of the regional office, but when it comes to administrative remedy, that is often at the phase where things are fixed.
Right.
Because a subject matter expert is looking at it, and then the legal staff, the regional legal counsel folks are looking at it, and they are looking at not just our answer is, okay, if this goes all the way through central office and then out to the court, is the position we've taken legally defensible? Is it consistent with policy? Is this consistent with the law? Are we making sense? So having that two people looking at that remedy is so important at the regional level.
And a lot of our correspondence goes at the regional level for that reason. One, it's where a lot of decision makers are too. But at the same time, man, if this thing goes up and it gets into even some sort of a legal challenge, then, you know, you had your chance, if you will, that we told you song, chapter, and verse what was going on with this situation. And, man, that is just that's just helped our clients so much, being able to, you know, have the regional and beyond sometimes see what's going on. And so that's the part of the advocacy that's the magic of the advocacy, is that it's the round peg, round hole experience, and it goes into the right people's hands and they make the adjustments and the changes. And so, well, anyway.
And while custody classification isn't nearly as convoluted as the First Step Act is, it's still about understanding. I mean, you can read what's there, but one of the things we do in the unlocking custody classification and designation and custody classification is we kind of give examples and kind of break it down. Way back 100 years ago when I was at Carswell, over at the Lowe, we actually offered a class to our folks over on Unit 2 up in the high rise, right? And we opened it up to all. It wasn't just my caseload. It was all three caseloads that were upstairs. And that's what we did. We gave examples. Like, what is the difference between minor violence and serious violence? And there is a difference. And does it matter if the person was actually hurt? No. It's aggressive or intimidating behavior likely to cause serious bodily injury or death. Doesn't mean you had to be successful. And so we would give actual examples. And that's what we do in the book. We give examples. We break it down. We see problems all the time in PSRs with pending charges or the...
Oh, or it's still open.
Yes. The way it's written, like, there's a question mark. I remember talking to a client and saying, oh, yeah, these two, like, the probation officer annotated no record of conviction. That is very different than dismissed. And he's telling us, oh, no, that was dismissed. I was like, well, that's not what your PSR says. And the Bureau will see that and go,
we're
still open, still pending. And they will score that. And that elevates
a chance. They're not going to take that chance.
And while pending charges don't impact pattern, which is great, it does impact your security level. And if that's the difference between being in a camp and being in a low, I can guarantee you, you're probably going to be further from home. Almost every institution has either a satellite camp or a minimum security unit located within the site, right? There's a couple who have internal sites, but the likelihood of being as close to home as possible happens with a camp placement. And a pending charge is just that one point makes the difference.
Right.
And then you're stuck.
And until it cleared. Until you get it cleared.
And you're not, DSCC Grand Prairie doesn't investigate pending charges.
No.
The volume of work that's coming through there, they read the PSR and they score it and they move on. And trying to get a reconsideration is all but impossible.
And we've instructed a lot of families, and man, since I've been doing this, you know, Susan, since day one, just having families go back and get the documentation from the court, you know, and getting that, and it's a while to clear, even though to get to DSCC and get it done right and stuff like that.
And in most cases, it's not going to get cleared up until the person gets to the institution. Now, yes, getting those documents, sending them to the institution can get it cleared up. Will expedite the process in terms of what the institution is looking for. But the best solution is information being correct in the PSR.
Yeah.
Another area where the PSR impacts that pattern is in instances that involve escape or violence. If there is no description about what happened, all they have to go on is the charge, whatever the actual conviction was, the narrative,
right,
and the sentence.
Hey, man, it was a domestic violence. He was 18. He slapped his girlfriend. They dropped it. Go ahead.
You know what I mean? It's still
right. If all it says is, you know, we've seen them, you know, right, assault, and they got 14 months. And then they were paroled after, because it's a state charge, maybe they were paroled after 6 or 8, whatever the case is with the state. Doesn't matter. If they don't have a description, they have assault and 14 months. That means felony. Means right, they're going to score it as a serious assault,
yeah,
as a serious history of violence.
Right.
That's a whole bunch of points walking in the door.
Right.
And I can all but guarantee you that's going to be enough to put you into a low.
I'm seeing here in Texas, I'm seeing a lot of Class C simple assaults, but they're still assaults. You know what I mean? And so it's interesting. I know it's a Class C misdemeanor, but wow, you know.
And that's why that narrative information, what happened? It was an assault, but what happened?
Right.
You know, an assault with no weapons, no injuries.
Oh, or some of them are actually sex offenses. It was actually some sort of a touching of somebody, and they played it back.
So
assault that's a non-registerable sex offense. But see, that's a whole lot different than somebody going out and having a fight at the bar, right, or whatever.
Absolutely.
But yet, that could be a simple assault. This other thing could be a simple assault. Yeah, yep. That's why we look at the what really
having
happened.
The narrative information is important. Now, if the narrative information is bad, and if it's actually worse than what the conviction sounds, and you were able to plead it down, you might not have that in there.
Right.
But I've seen also cases where follow-up information was received. I had a case way back in the day that when, because the information in the PSR was vague. And so I, as a case manager doing my job, reached out to that agency and said, hey, we have just like this vague one sentence thing, and we're trying to assess violence. They sent us in the documentation, and the reality was it was a pretty violent domestic assault. He actually battered her with a weapon. It wasn't just him slapping her. There was actually a weapon involved. And it was because the PSR was written in a way that was very obtusely written. So as a case manager, I followed up and got the information, and he was removed from camp. So, and that's what a case manager should do.
Right.
Does that happen all the time? Are case managers relying just on what's there? Yes. But when it comes to a vague entry.
Right. So, and again, I know many of y'all listening are hearing us while your loved one's already incarcerated, but for those of you that are new to this, you've just received a target letter, your pretrial, you've just maybe retained your attorney or maybe even a public defender or whatever, but that's great. But, man, you may want to have consultants assist you as you go through the pre-sentence report process to make sure that that is written in such a way that's truthful. But it's also truthful, right? It doesn't leave out stuff. You know, many times they leave out stuff that can help you, your level of education, verified education, citizenship said correctly, those types of things that you would think you could take for granted. And man, oh man, here we go. We've had those cases, right, Susan? And we just like, holy smokes, having to turn the car around 180 degrees while it's going 50 miles an hour to get these guys and ladies, whatever. Also,
well, you know, something as simple as high school education. We've got a case right now. They're not wanting to release the PSR, so we can't review it. We're talking to the family. We've gotten some documentation the family's been able to get. But however the PSR is written with regard to education, the Bureau is looking at it as if he does not have one and does not have a high school diploma. That's 2 points. And when you're talking about being right on the cusp to the next security level, 2 points is a lot.
It's a lot.
You know, so, and again, without the document, we weren't able to see that and help with a correction. Now it's done. And he's at this point, going to go to a more secure facility. Yes, we're going to get the documentation to the institution to facilitate some updates being made, you know, as quickly as possible. But, you know, again, now he's got these extra points, short sentence, going to get time credits, already has jail credit, getting conduct time.
Is that the guy who might be going to a meeting, but by the time we've got the fix in, he'll be camp?
Yeah.
That's another guy. Yeah, okay.
Yep. No, that is the one.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah. Yep. Amazing, right? And so to go from a medium.
And it's a lot of little things that, and again, not having the PSR, we kind of just went through some of the information we do have. And
all right, man, we're about 2¾ minutes.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So, do you want to talk about next week? We're going to have a guest on.
Hey, next week we have a guest, folks. A guest. This guest is now on supervised release under federal probation, but served their time in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Not only were they a recipient of some of the CARES Act release, they were also a First Step Act recipient as well. And so they're going to talk about their experience navigating how they navigated their federal sentence and they're going to talk about that. So it's really good to hear from a consumer of correctional services perspective.
Absolutely.
That looks like you're just not hearing us and our perspective. So we're going to make sure that we have former inmate guests on the show.
I think it's also important. We're going to be able to talk about how we navigated reentry. I think for a lot of our folks, they're just focused on getting home.
Yeah.
And that's reasonable. But that's a whole nother set of challenges.
Yeah, it is.
And I think, you know, paying attention to that and hearing that, you know, beats the challenges and then overcoming them.
Right. Books. Absolutely. So what we were talking about with classification, this is called the Green Book, Unlocking Classification. First Step Act, the Blue Book. Okay. First Step Act credits. All right, this one for classification if you are coming into the federal system. So these books are a fantastic resource. Not one person has said, oh, man, such and so's book is more descriptive. No, this is it. There is no other John Brown's book is better. Not when it comes to this. This stuff is hot off the press, and very, very specific, very detailed. And so make sure you get your copies if you need to. Tune in next week. We're going to have a special guest. Join us on our Facebook group, Early Release from First Step Act, Early Release from Federal Prison. I think we're up to 11,000 families now. Thank you very much. And this podcast will be on the First Step Act YouTube channel. It'll be archived on LA Talk Radio. The video will be there too, and I believe we're now finally on Apple Podcast.
Excellent! Congratulations! Good job! I know you've been working on that.
I've been working on that. So Good stuff, folks. Well, again, thank you for being there. Thank you for being listening to the show.
And please post your questions either to YouTube or to the Facebook page. We really love answering your questions.
Love your questions. All right. Well, have a blessed week. We'll see you here next time on Around the Block, Federal Prison Authority. Y'all take care. Bye.
Take care.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.